Hello!
Hi!
I'm Max.
And I'm Tess.
And we are Extraordinary Brains Podcast.
That we are.
And we haven't done an episode for quite a long time.
We really haven't, that's true.
You've been away.
I've had my GCSEs as well.
Yes, you had your GCSEs, then
I'm
you
finished,
have
yeah.
been to Cornwall.
I did.
I then got ill.
You did.
And now I'm finally, we're both better and also here.
That's true. These are all facts.
I've laid out a number of facts.
Over the period of time between the last episode, my friends actually found this podcast.
So hello,
shout
Tess's
out to
friends.
Them if they're listening to this. Yeah, they yeah. probably aren't.
Well, I hope they do, because I think it's a good one. It's slightly delayed. It's a slightly unfortunate delay because we missed the publication of Joshua Muggleton, who and his book came out a couple of weeks ago, but it's a sort of late push for publicity, really.
Yeah.
His book is developing differently, and I can say, having read quite a few books, I think it's the best book about parenting a child who is neurodivergent that I've ever read. And it's definitely a book that I would want the parent of children with certainly autism, which is really something that he knows an awful lot about.
I've never read a book about raising a child who is neurodivergent, so by my standards it is the best book
ever. But you also haven't read the book.
I haven't. I've lost the ability to read.
It's the best book about raising
that I've
a child
ever
heard of. Never heard of.
Yeah,
exactly right. It's very, very good, and Josh is a lovely man and very, very thoughtful, and himself autistic, so really has a fantastic kind of perspective on the problems of neurodivergence, and both by his own experience and also in his work as a psychologist,
yeah,
which is what he is. Anyway, we'll stop gassing and we'll come back to you at the end.
Is that a phrase?
Yes, it's a phrase.
I wish you'd stop gassing more often.
Ooh, thank you very much. All right.
See you.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Today we are delighted to be joined by someone I've worked with before and talked to before, and I'm excited to talk to again, Josh Muggleton, an autistic clinical psychologist and author.
Yes.
An author who specializes in neurodevelopmental conditions. And one of the people that made me think of this little mini series on neurodiverse people who work with neurodiversity. I must come up with a better neater title. For
there must be an acronym in there somewhere.
Oh, don't worry. That's a researcher there. You do research and stuff, so they love their acronyms. The kind of spiral study is underway, that sort of thing. They like that. Anyway, one day, Tess, when you're a researcher.
I'm not going to be a researcher.
No, you may not be, actually. You might
I'm
not,
not
be
a very, very good at organising information.
Yeah, not a meticulous person like me. Right, I'm not a researcher. Right, anyway, shall we talk to Josh?
Yes,
hello.
Probably. Hi.
How are you doing?
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Great. Really great to see you. Well, we're just sort of slightly waking up. Shall we just crack straight on with our first question then?
Yeah.
I think we should. So, Josh, thinking about when you were growing up, when did you become aware of your difference and how did that feel?
That's a tricky question because I think growing up, I didn't necessarily have the insight to realise that I was different, but looking back, I can certainly recognise things. So one of my earliest memories was at playgroup, and they had this kind of giant construction set, and often they can, the like playgroup workers construct it to be a house for people to kind of like go in and pretend it was a house. But sometimes they constructed it into a windmill, and everyone loved it when it was made into a windmill, and people would kind of like put it in the sand pit and they'd climb on it and kind of like push sand from one end to the other while turning the handle, and can like pretend that they were like milling sand, which didn't really make sense to me. And I'd stand there and I'd watch these kids wondering why they were doing this with the sand, doing this over and over and over again. And I'd wait until they would get off it. And then I would go up, and there was a kind of the windmill blades and a handle to turn them. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by how at the edges of the windmill blades, they seemed to turn quicker than in the middle. And so I turned the windmill blades, watching them move. But I'd only do that if there was no one else playing on it.
Right. Mm.
So looking back, yeah, that was, I suppose, quite an autistic thing for me to be doing and thinking. But at the time, I certainly didn't have the realization. I think that sort of happened more in primary school. And certainly in primary school, I started to get quite depressed because I just didn't get on and understand people. I couldn't get friendships to work. And, you know, part of that might have been that I quite enjoyed, you know, even in the heat of summer, going up in this thick winter coat and walking around the lines of the playground. So, like, you know how they'll put, like, on the tarmac playground, they might put football court in white lines and then a netball court in blue lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'd, like, try and work out what's the quickest way or the shortest distance to get from point A to point B without going through a certain line. And I'd trace it out walking through, trying to find... Basically, it's graph theory. I was just trying to go through and do that.
It'd probably be a nice little mobile game that everyone would be playing now.
And it's even more challenging when people are actually playing football on it at the same time.
Well, that's level three.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly.
Start getting the music obstacles.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you can imagine it now. Maybe get George to make it.
Yeah, someday.
Tess's younger brother, who's a wannabe coder. Aspiring game designer. Exactly, that's what he is.
I'm jealous. My dad, my uncle, and my grandfather were all very kind of computer codey people, and kind of did jobs related to that. I tried it, and I do not have a brain for code.
All right.
Which initially disappointed me because I thought, you know, it's kind of the stereotype that autistic people are kind of good with Amazing. Coding and stuff.
Yeah.
No, definitely not me.
And I think even from the couple of things you've said, it's not even a smashing of stereotypes. It's gentle pushing against them, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite you, I think. You know what I mean? Because when you think about the autistic child who is watching a washing machine spin, or, you know, those kind of things mm-hmm. that you hear in when you're being taught about autism, or watching some windmill wheels spin, you think of it, it's almost presented as a mindless thing, as a kind of satisfying some kind of base, you know, kind of brainstem sensory need. Do you see what I mean? Rather than anything high-minded or cognitive. But actually, I think you're right to think about it. The real question is, what is it that they're fascinated by and what are they thinking, rather than what, you know, is this, what kind of animalistic urge is this kind of, you know, satisfying for them? And the same is true of that, your sort of graph theory game that you played with yourself in school. Because it's interesting, because I think probably quite a few people will have had a fleeting thought of doing that, but didn't follow it through. Do you see what I mean? Certainly, when I looked at those courts, was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what the patterns are here.
Yeah.
But then I would go and get distracted and go and do something else. I never had the kind of persistence to actually follow through and work it out. I was always just speculating while I was running from one place to another.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is the difference between ADHD and autism.
This is why I think ADHD and autism work so well together, because there's a few people I've worked with who have ADHD, and it's great because they've got all the energy and enthusiasm and lots of ideas and kind of saying, what about this? What about this? Whereas I tend to be kind of the very slow, methodical one doing, okay, well, we're going to do this bit next, then we're going to do that bit. And I think the two together is magic.
It is magic, unless they're in the same person, in which case it can be very difficult.
Yes. Yes, can be.
And that's the paradox, isn't it, in a way?
Mm-hmm.
You almost need two different people. What?
Yeah.
This is Tess's signal for, I'm lost.
No, I kind of get it. But, I mean, I wouldn't know. I'm not autistic.
No, but so, I think you have an understanding of autism, and I think yours is probably, in some way, more sophisticated than a lot of clinicians, a lot of doctors. Because I think you think of it. Well, I think you've
put
got
that on my CV.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just the key is to move away from stereotypes, and the key is to move away from pathologizing people. I don't know. Well, what do you think, Josh? And the question that we were asking, but that's fine. It's very much part of our brand to get off track.
No, I think one of the things that I'm kind of seeing and I suppose hoping that we're going to move towards is, I think at the moment there's this idea that you have typical and then you have atypical, which is somehow by definition pathological. And I think actually it'd be really good to move to a point where we are saying, well, yes, this is typical in a statistical sense, and this is atypical, but atypical does not mean pathological.
Mm.
What's pathological mean?
Pathological means, well, you go.
So that there's something, that's a pretty good question, actually. What is pathological? I suppose the technical kind of medical definition would probably be that there's something that is wrong or detrimental.
Mm. Oh, okay, yeah. Like a pathological liar.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good example.
Because that's the only context in which I've really heard it before.
Yeah.
Sorry, carry on.
So pathological changes within the body, another way of explaining it, I suppose, is pathological changes within the body is a finding which is harmful to the body as a whole.
Yeah.
So it's something that is harmful to the person who has this feature.
Oh, right, yeah.
Or to others, actually, because actually quite a lot of the time, in this particular area, the pathology is actually whether the person is, do you see what I mean? How they react with other people. It's not necessarily the person themselves who's harmed by this feature, which is another weird feature of neurodevelopmental conditions.
Yeah, and I think it's tricky as well when we think about like the social model of disability, which I'm guessing you're both familiar with.
What
model?
The social model of disability.
The social model. I just missed that one word. Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. So not social model of disability kind of says that it's not the person that is inherently disabled. It's it's the society and environment that's disabling. And so we need to change the society and environment. And I think for a lot of people, that is a very valid and very helpful model. There are some children I meet who I think are really impaired by their differences. And maybe it's my limitations that I'm struggling to conceptualize how we could create an environment that could meet their needs, that isn't going to also cause them harm. So some children I meet who we really struggle. So I work with a lot of children with intellectual disability. Or genetic disorders, and they've got such great characters and so many great qualities, but at the same time some of them have behaviors where they really hurt themselves, and it's really hard to work out what it is we need to change to mean that they're not hurting themselves. And it's really tricky because I feel like I need to watch my language very carefully, because I think that there are lots of people where neurodiversity is a fantastic thing. And yes, it's society that makes it tricky sometimes to be neurodiverse.
Mm.
But I think there are a much smaller group where actually, and again, maybe it's my limitations, I can't fully understand what it is, but where it's much harder for us to work out what we need to change in the environment in society to make it work for them.
I think that's, I mean, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think that the social model of disability has made a really great contribution to the debate, but I think it doesn't mean that one has to adopt it lock, stock and barrel, in a sense, and almost erase the biological or genetic components of disability to say that, you know, it's purely socially constructed, which kind of doesn't make sense, because conceptually I don't think it makes sense, because if you completely erase the difference, then what are you actually adjusting to? You know, we have this concept of reasonable adjustments in disability or in difference. Well, if you don't know what you're adjusting to because you've erased it using this social model, then then actually it disappears, and then actually the whole system collapses. And I think on a practical level, part of the impairment caused by these different kind of differences and disabilities is interaction with society. People are not isolated. People are not islands.
Yeah.
And actually, when you if everyone got all of the adjustments that they need to be for their environment to be perfectly adjusted to them, well, actually, those adjustments would clash.
Yeah.
So I might need something fast. Like, even if you and I are both in a classroom, I imagine if we were both the same age in the classroom, I would need quite quick. I would need a lot of quite quick information. You might need it, at a slower pace, not because you're less intelligent, but because of the you have a different way that your brain works. And I will make many more careless mistakes than you. Mm-hmm. Blah blah blah. So even on that mundane level, we exist in society and we interact with other people. And if we actually want to continue to do that as neurodiverse people, there's going to have to be a degree of compromise.
Yeah. On both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, and it's not like we can really put children into, well, this is the class for ADHD children.
Oh, can you imagine? This is,
that would be an absolute nightmare, I think.
Sadly, the class for ADHD children is the pupil referral unit.
It often is
the exclusion unit. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously something that makes me very angry. I mean it's not just ADHD kids. If I think about our PRU, there's autistic kids there as well, but there's a huge amount of ADHD kids
and a lot of kids I imagine with language issues, often quite massive, subtle language issues that really end up with this miscommunication, this kind of frustration trying to get out what you're trying to say.
Yeah. And a good pupil referral unit. So for people, probably international listeners, of which we have some, we do. There's a little map of where all our listeners come from.
Oh, nice.
Yes. And there's sort of odd things. There's the occasional Moldovan tunes in, which is nice. Hello, Moldova. Moldova, you have received 12 points. That's a Eurovision joke.
The Moldova in Eurovision was very good.
Was it good?
I think, were they the ones who did the... Sorry, this is completely off topic.
That's fine.
But were they the ones who did the one that was like, that was quite silly and it got those points?
I didn't listen. I didn't watch Eurovision.
That wasn't a question to you. It was a general question.
Okay. Internet, please tell us, was it Moldova?
And if you're from Moldova, please let us know.
Anyway, that sentence started off with me saying a pupil referral unit is essentially a school where you get the local authority, local council, whatever you want to call it, will send you if you are excluded or your current school can't cope with you. So that's what those are. And what I was going to say was that they're very largely the ones that I know of. Well, the really brilliant one that I know of in Lambeth, where I work, who are amazing, Kennington Park Academy, are basically they're just assessing these children and trying to find a way back. Mm-hmm. And so they do a huge amount of assessment and, kind of referral off to sort of find out what's actually going on with these children. And that's a lot of their job.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily done that well within the mainstream vision.
You've got to look behind the behaviour. You've got to try and understand how someone thinks and what their experiences have been, if you want to help them to learn and to grow.
Yeah, you have to understand it.
Talking about understanding neurodiversity, Josh, what was your process towards understanding your difference?
Very good. Segue.
Nice segue. I like it.
Nice.
So, excuse me, I'm fighting a cough. Not COVID, thankfully.
Hooray.
Hooray.
So I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me, who was diagnosed with autism when he was about three, so in the early 90s. And my parents, kind of off the back of that, got very involved with the local branch of the National Autistic Society. And they brought a guy called Tony Atwood over to do a big kind of day-long seminar on autism. And Tony Atwood, especially then, and I think still is, quite a big name in autism.
He's massive, yeah.
And my dad, being the slightly techie guy he is, was kind of tasked with setting up to record the lecture series that he was doing for us that day. And he was listening to it in the car with all of us in it. And Tony was talking about, as it was then, Asperger's syndrome.
Mm.
And I listened to it, and then I borrowed the cassette, because back when we had cassettes.
Yes.
And I listened to it again. And yeah, the penny just kind of dropped, and I realized he's talking about me.
Wow.
And I remember...
How old were you roughly then? You said primary school, you said?
Yeah, I reckon 11, 12. Wow. Something like that. Because, you know, all 11 and 12-year-olds like to listen to lectures on tape.
Yeah. I mean, Tess has got a 12-year-old brother. He's definitely listening to a lecture on tape upstairs.
Yeah, that's what he does with his friends on Discord all day. Listen to loads and loads of intellectual lectures.
Can't beat it.
Can't beat it.
So, yeah, and then I got out. I kind of said to my parents, I think I have this Asperger's thing. And they were a bit sceptical at the time. I think because it was generally my difficulties were put down to anxiety and mood.
Mm. And what were the difficulties at the time? So because you sort of talked a little bit about earlier years. When did the anxiety and mood start to become more prominent for you?
Certainly, I remember in year 5 of primary school, my teacher calling my parents in because we were assigned a poetry task, and I'd written this very bleak, very disturbing, depressing poem, and they were quite worried about me. And probably quite rightly. And then when I moved to secondary school, everything fell apart, and right. I became very depressed. I became suicidal. And I got into child and adolescent mental health services quite quickly. And it was after a few years in CAMS that they said, by the way, Josh, we think you're autistic. And I said, yes, what took you so long?
Because, of course, by then you'd worn out your Tony Atwood tape.
Yes, pretty much. So that didn't really come as a surprise to me.
No.
But it was just the social stuff at secondary school, the change, the fact that a teacher will say one thing, but then a different teacher will say something else.
Oh yeah.
Or the secondary school I went to was, it was a very big secondary school on a huge campus. And it had two main buildings, and you had a 5-minute movement break to get from one lesson to the other. And if you were at the far side of one building, had to go to the far side of the other building, you had to sprint. And I was doing that. I couldn't stand the idea of getting a detention. So, yeah. And I saw someone in my first week get a detention for not remembering to bring the right textbook.
Yeah.
So I brought every single textbook, workbook, piece of stationery, everything I could possibly need in my bag every day.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of carrying this, basically it was a Bergen, all the way from one to the other. And yeah, it was not good. It was a pretty dark time.
So you must have been in pain, and you must have been constantly stressed.
Yeah, I didn't sleep properly for years. I'd kind of go to bed worrying about it, maybe get to sleep around 2 a.m., then wake up for school at 7.
So constantly sleep deprived. And the social stuff, I mean, you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but the social stuff, what was it, that transition to secondary that really made social interaction and friendships extra difficult? Was that what happened? Or
yeah, I think so. I think primary school, there was the benefit of that you're in the same class throughout, pretty much, and that helped. And it's much smaller. It's easier to build a relationship with some of the teachers. Whereas at secondary school, you're kind of on your own, almost. And the classes are much bigger, and they're they change according to subject.
Mm.
And yeah, it just, I think partly my organizational skills at that point weren't great. So it was partly that and partly...
Why you went for the Bergen option, which actually I have to say, at least one of my children, Nora, still does.
Yeah.
Because I'm so forgetful.
Well, you and your brother do it.
Well, do we?
Yeah, John does it as well.
George has
done this
for years.
It's not good for you. To this day, I still kind of lean forward because I was carrying this bag for that was so heavy for so long. Mm. Yeah. So that didn't go very well. And then around. excuse me. I think I got partway into year 11, I think it was. Maybe it was year 10. And I was signed off school by my psychiatrist.
Right.
And honestly, it was the best day of my life.
Really?
The weight that lifted off my shoulders. I slept for hours. It was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was just incredible.
So that obviously was part of the weightlifting. What helped? What brought you back in a sense? Or what, you know, sort of what was the thing that sort of led you to then get to where you are now, having been signed off school?
So I tried kind of studying from home, and we did a few different there's a few different organizations which kind of do home study for kids. And I could do that fine until I had to set exams. And I was doing science subjects and you had to do the practical exam in a school. And I couldn't go into a school. And we were kind of a bit stuck as to what to do because my mental health at that point was quite fragile. And we ended up finding a specialist school for young people who were autistic. It's actually a specialist college. And I went there. And it was really tough. It was residential and it was down in Somerset. So it was, you know, a good 100 or so miles away from home. Mm. And that was really tough, but I didn't have any other, this was kind of a last ditch, didn't know where else I could go. Mm. And that kind of helped start to turn things around. Mm. And I mean, they didn't do anything particularly revolutionary. Actually, what helped was I'd go to lectures and there would be someone who was there who would, A, take notes for me, but B, I knew and was just a bit of a confidence boost that I could be in a classroom again.
Kind of an anchor for your day, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. They got me to use public transport, which is something I couldn't do before. I mean, admittedly, you know, so it was getting the bus from the college that I attended to the residence. And that worked great because I kind of knew exactly when to press the button. Because I've learned that there was an art to button pressing on buses, because you press it too early, then you end up coming off at the stop before you wanted.
Yes.
And if you press it too late, then you make the bus driver very angry because you have to slam on the brakes.
Yes. It's one of those subtle unwritten rules of communication that we always talk about when we talk about autism, don't we?
Exactly.
Like if you press the button too early, then the bus driver thinks that you wanted to get off on the stop.
And that you just left.
That you just left. And so he's like, oh, sorry. And he stops the bus again. And you're like, no.
No, it's the next one.
There's the next one.
But there is an etiquette to it, which is never, ever written down.
Yeah. I normally rely on the other people who are getting off on my stop.
Exactly. And that's... so then when I went to university, that's what I had to rely on initially until I found my new kind of like points where I had to kind of identify, right, that is the optimal button pressing time. But yeah, because I got that support at college, I suddenly went from quite, you know, mediocre grades in a handful of subjects because I'd had to cut my curriculum down massively to actually quite good grades. And I realized I could actually do stuff.
Mm.
And then I went to university and they had, I think part of it is just that the university, it was quite small. So I went to St. Andrews, which is this really nice small university out in the countryside, and it's like a, people call it the bubble when you're there, and it was, it felt like a bubble and you were quite isolated from the rest of the world, and it was brilliant. And they also do something called academic parenting.
Okay.
Where like third and fourth years adopt incoming freshers. And we happened to have a family friend who had a son with autism and a daughter at St. Andrews in third year, or no, fourth year at the time. So her daughter kind of adopted me and understood what I might find tricky and really helped me to kind of settle in and feel comfortable there. And it was just the perfect environment for me.
That's great. And so while I'm thinking about, because what the sort of thrust of our second question is how your understanding and diagnosis in your case helped you. So what, just to kind of go back through that great story, what was the significance of diagnosis in that story? What did it matter to you, or was it just a kind of footnote?
I think it was a bit of nice validation, but I think what really helped was the psychologist I was working with, I think quite early on realized that trying to do kind of like cognitive challenging with me, trying to kind of show the flaws in my arguments was not going to work, because these were things I spent far too much time thinking about. But what she did spend a lot of time doing was helping me and her to understand how my brain worked and why I found certain things tricky, why I was good at certain things. And that didn't need a diagnosis. And we did a lot of that before I got a diagnosis.
Yes.
But that kind of process effectively of understanding why I was finding things tricky, but also understanding my neurotype, that's what I think helped. That's what was more meaningful, I think, to me than necessarily the diagnosis itself.
And that's interesting. I mean, the obvious point, I suppose somebody might listening to this go, well, you got, obviously the college that you went to was very helpful to you and it is reserved for people who are autistic. So therefore you, by definition, probably it was a gateway into other things that were helpful. I suppose that's another thing that
very fair point
could say about it. I mean, I would always argue back that that's a bit of a circular argument, because I mean, if you're arguing against the importance of diagnosis, well, if something that's helpful, which is not actually to do with, you know what I mean? It's just a kind of way of filtering people. Then there's nothing inherent to the diagnosis. But anyway, I'm not here to kind of knock down diagnosis, because I literally do it myself.
Yeah. I think diagnosis can be hugely valuable. I think it can be very validating for a person. And sometimes it's not even, when I've been working clinically, sometimes it's not even the diagnosis on a piece of paper. It's actually a professional doing that kind of bit of assessment and actually just saying, yeah, I agree. I think you are neurodiverse. I think you're autistic. I think you think differently. And sometimes just having someone acknowledge that in itself is really powerful. But the thing on a piece of paper is also really, some people really need that kind of, it's there, black and white. And like you say, unfortunately, we're still in a position where it opens doors. Sorry.
I think one of the things that I like about, though, you're right, because when I assess a family or a child, one of the moments, obviously giving a diagnosis can be a nice moment, but actually one of the nicest moments is if you get the opportunity to say, I believe you, you're right about this. There is something going on. It isn't just because your husband left you, or it isn't just because, I think in a way we were talking before we started recording about some of the stigmatizing way people talk about fetal alcohol effects. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just because you had a couple of drinks when you were I will answer that question, Tess, when you were pregnant. You know, there's lots of other stuff going on.
Oh,
here. So, there is good sound advice that pregnant people shouldn't drink, and that's fine.
I was just thinking like maybe fetal was being used in another context, but no, that does make sense.
Yeah. But sometimes that's, if you happen to have drunk, even if you didn't know you were pregnant, or you drank a little bit, but not too much, there is a bit of a tendency sometimes for professionals to seize on that and try and tell you that that's why your child has X or Y problem.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure about as a is a particularly. I mean, it's not even whether it's right or wrong. I don't know how helpful it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of comes back to me about what is a diagnosis meant to be. And for me, yes, it's become a key to access services, which I don't think it should be. I think that's kind of a what we've got to because, you know, money's tight everywhere. And so people are raising thresholds and looking for criteria. But I think really a diagnosis should be a communication tool and a tool that helps everyone understand a person, including the person themselves. And I think I think a good diagnosis helps people make sense, and there's that sense making. And I think, yeah. And again, this is why sometimes I see children who have this kind of whole alphabet of letters of diagnoses, and I'm sure they're all valid, but that doesn't explain the person. And actually it needs a bit of sitting down and really thinking how does this child think?
Mm.
How do we understand that? How can we put ourselves in their shoes?
Yes. And one of the difficulties, I can get onto a whole rant about this, because we focus on making the diagnosis, not actually understanding the person. And we spend all of our time doing these instruments that are designed to do the first, but don't actually spend any time on the second, on actually understanding the person. But all of that takes time. And that's the difficulty in the system, which is either cash strapped or in other systems where you have to pay for the time. Yeah. And so it's, you know, how much time people spend understanding you depends on how much money you have. Which doesn't seem fair either. I suppose the question I've been thinking about was, so at what point did you decide to pursue clinical psychology as a kind of, as your kind of a profession? And when did you then choose to focus on neurodevelopmental stuff?
So during my A-levels, in my first year, I did maths, physics, and business. And then I realised partway through the year that I could not do physics to save my life. So then in second year, I decided to pick up psychology because it seemed interesting. And a few weeks in, I just thought, this is easy. And maybe that's because I'm particularly good at psychology. Maybe it's because the A-level was a bit easier than maths.
Good news for me. I'm taking it.
Yeah, this is going to be a psychology A-level.
And they offered a one-year version to do both years of the psychology A-level. So I thought, right, I'm going to do that. And I still loved it. And so I decided at that point, it was like, okay, this is what I want to do for a degree. And I was really interested in what my psychologist had done and why they did it. I'm not sure what she thought about the idea of me pursuing clinical psychology, but at that point I kind of said to her, right, I'm going to go to university, I'm going to do psychology, I'm going to become a clinical psychologist. It was just, I loved understanding how people think. And why people do the things they do. And that has stayed with me throughout. I'm currently studying pediatric clinical neuropsychology to try and understand how the brain builds itself and why it can wire itself differently. I'm really interested in something called behavioral economics, which is kind of where psychology and economics meet and how people make really odd decisions. So like, if there is a sale and every duvet is 50% off,
yeah,
a lot of people might need a double duvet, but let's see, I can get a king size for less than the price that I would that I budgeted for my double, so I'm going to get the king size, even though they don't need it, and it makes no sense to spend more money when they could spend less money to get exactly what they need. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And more is not always better.
Mm-hmm.
But if the king size is less expensive than the double, is that what you said?
Yeah, so the king size, let's say the double, to pick some easy numbers, is usually £50 and the king size is 75. If they're both half price.
Oh, I see. If you save more on a king size, you'll buy a king size because the saving is greater.
Yeah.
Even though actually you're shelling out more money on something you don't need. Yes, I understand what you're saying. I get that now.
Yeah.
Or
one of the things, another bit of this is confirmation bias, which I think affects clinicians quite a lot that we don't really talk about.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there have been times when I've been working with
people. Is it worth just explaining what confirmation bias is? You will know, probably, because you're doing...
Vaguely.
All right, let's just explain confirmation bias, because it's actually really important for neurodevelopmental conditions, I think, as well.
So confirmation bias is when we seek out an overweight information that confirms our suspicions. So the example I always give of this is... I remember seeing someone in my CAMS placement for anxiety, for panic. And
international listeners, CAMS is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. Continue. Yeah.
And I remember them saying, you know, talking about having all these symptoms of panic, and I sort of said, before you had that first panic attack, did you have a lot of coffee, a lot of energy drinks? And they said, yes, how did you know? And I kind of had this nice warm feeling of, yes, I know how to do my job, I can predict this. But actually, that's confirmation bias. I should really, if I'm being scientific about it, I should be trying to disprove what I think is going on, rather than thinking, right, I think this is panic, so I'm going to ask all the questions that are going to confirm that this is panic, because then I'm just going to find what I'm looking for.
Yeah. And it's directly around neurodevelopmental conditions. This is why I thump the table and get very cross about this. We should not be assessed. If someone comes to me from a non-developmental service and wants me to assess for X condition, I will always say, I'm not assessing for this condition. I'm going to assess this person.
Yes.
And I try really hard not to have too much information, which is going to send me down one rabbit hole. Mm. It's not easy. You can never completely get rid of it. I was thinking about some of what you were saying, and when you're trying to do so much in an assessment, there's a little bit that creeps in. So I think that may be, you know, you have a problem with sleep, and I'm like, is it because, you know, there's a change in the environment, that's why you wake up at night? That's a little bit of confirmation bias, because I am thinking that's the pattern that I usually see. So I'm kind of, do you fit this pattern that I usually see? Because that will save me a lot of time rather than being extremely meticulous about it, because I haven't got an hour, I've got 5 minutes, I guess, is one thing.
Yeah, it's mental shortcuts that we all do. And usually they're helpful. It's just sometimes they're really not.
Yeah. And it takes time and experience to know which ones are helpful and which are not, really. And maybe I kind of, because it's something I'm so passionate about, I maybe kind of just shout about it too much, and I should relax a little bit. But I think you're right, though, because confirmation bias is really important.
But this kind of understanding how people work, you know, going back to me watching these kids in the playgroup with the windmill, part of me was wondering, why are they finding this so interesting?
Yes.
And I've kind of kept that kind of curiosity as to why everyone else does the things that they do and thinks the way that they do. And actually, when I speak to other autistic clinical psychologists, it's often quite the same thing. It's this kind of, well, I've always been interested to try and understand how people work, because that was quite adaptive early on.
Excuse me. A fascination with the human condition.
But I think I was wondering, because we do see a lot of neurodiverse people in psychology, psychiatry, this bit of pediatrics that I do. So you think in a sense your own autism has made you more, you know, I'm cautious about saying a better clinical psychologist because there's all sorts of baggage about that, if you see what I mean. But given you that curiosity, that then
it gives me I suppose it gives me a different maybe additional source of motivation, and I think it gives me a different perspective. I don't think that one perspective is necessarily better than another, but I think when you have lots of people working in a service with lots of different perspectives, with lots of different strengths, I think that's, again, that's where the magic happens. It's where you have lots of different neurotypes together. So, for example, my supervisor for a long time, we would always say that she is on a mission to make me more flexible and I'm on a mission to make her more rigid. Because I was very much about following processes and doing things exactly, whereas she was all about sort of doing things, not ignoring processes, but being flexible with them. And and I like to think that, yes, I was more flexible, but I've also made her a bit more rigid.
Well, there you go. So everyone's a winner.
Yeah.
I just think we only have really one neurotype in our house, apart from Mum.
Big up, Mum.
We probably need some more different neurotypes.
It does manifest in different ways.
Yeah, it does manifest in
different ways. So we're basically talking about it already, but I may as well ask the third question now. How do you feel about your difference now?
I think I've got more comfortable with it. I think for a long time, it almost felt like it was the defining thing about me. And then I think I kind of got, not that I was ever uncomfortable being autistic, but it now feels easier for it to be a part of me without being necessarily the central part of me.
Yeah.
Ironically, I think it was then replaced by being a clinical psychologist, and I'm now in the process of being comfortable with the idea that actually there is more to me than being a clinical psychologist.
Yes.
As well.
It's one of those professions that does become all-encompassing, isn't it?
Yeah. Which can be a double-edged sword. But yeah, I think, I remember at university being, feeling that I had to try and be social, that I had to try and do all these things. And I was very aware of when I found things too much, and I felt I got quite annoyed and quite depressed if I wasn't able to do something or did find something too much or too overwhelming. Actually, now I feel much more comfortable saying, actually, you know what, that just isn't me. Rather than being on the outskirts kind of a party or at a wedding thinking, I don't feel part of this, I'm like from the outside looking in.
Yes.
Actually being comfortable being the person there who's just observing and just noticing what's going on.
Yes.
Without that needing to be a problem. So yeah, I think more comfortable.
I think that's really interesting. I think about myself actually in a way, because I, although not autistic, I don't find conventional social gatherings easy either. Chat is not something that, small talk has never been something that I'm strong at. And you said weddings and other things, I've often, just felt on the outside of as well. And it's interesting. I think my natural reaction, other people's natural reaction may be, oh, I should be able to do this, I'm bad, what's wrong with me? My natural reaction, being a basically quite arrogant person, is what's wrong with them? Why are they talking about this nonsense? And to feel a little bit superior. But they're both dysfunctional reactions in a sense.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, just to say, well, I'm just a bit different to them, and that's fine, and there's nothing wrong with them either. Is probably the best. And you can think about you on the outside of a wedding and then think about that as a metaphor for being slightly on the outside of society as a whole, but it doesn't have to be either self-hatred or hatred of other. I suppose that's where you've got to get to at some point, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think that, and maybe it's something that everyone has, that as they, you know, whether or not they're neurodivergent, they kind of are getting comfortable with yourself as a person. Because I think, you know, being a psychologist, and you know, there's this whole identity formation in teenage years and kind of getting comfortable. So maybe it's just part of that.
Great.
But yeah, no, it does feel, it feels a bit easier to be
me. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that is a process that different people have at different rates. And I suspect some people never get there, which is a shame. Mm-hmm. I suspect the more time you spend on Twitter, the less maturity you manage, because you're constantly being told to hate the other. Anyway, I'm a bit down on Twitter at the moment.
Twitter sucks. It's fun, but it sucks. There's a hate culture to it.
Yeah, there is. But there's also, even if it's a well-meaning hate culture, anyway, even the good guys are bad guys on Twitter, I think, sometimes. There you go. There's your aphorism of the day. should we do question four? We haven't even talked about your book yet. I haven't forgotten.
That's fine.
Just before we do question four, I was going to ask this earlier. What does being a clinical psychologist actually entail?
Well, that's such a great question. Assumed knowledge, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the first thing I'm going to say is it's not a psychiatrist, because often that's what people confuse. So I'm not a medical doctor. I've not been to medical school. I kind of have studied how people think, and so my training is much more in psychological therapies to try and understand how to apply psychological theory and research to mental health situations, and how we can use that to help people to feel better, to cope better, to understand themselves better. That said, I often say that I'm a pretty bad psychologist, because I don't really like a lot of talking therapy. I'm much more interested in a slightly more niche area, which is trying to understand how a person's brain's working.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm kind of interested in neurodevelopment, neuropsychology. So I do a lot of things like IQ tests and memory assessments and assessments for like problem solving skills.
Hmm.
To try and understand if a child's having difficulties, why is that? Can I pinpoint, for example, that they've got a very specific issue with language that I can then say, right, okay, so these are the strategies that might help this person in everyday life. So that's kind of my niche to it. But clinical psychology is much broader, and it's much more about, yeah, applying knowledge, psychological knowledge and theory to a person, to a service, to try and help it think, help it work a bit better.
And it's really interesting to kind of to go back to your experience of having a psychologist yourself, because you mentioned briefly, I think it was her, challenging your, you know, how the challenging of your cognitions, the challenging your thoughts wasn't terribly helpful. And it's worth just emphasizing that particularly CBT, one of the, obviously, the bread and butter of talking therapy, the kind of McDonald's of talking therapy, one could say.
Well, I don't think it describes the McDonald's or anything.
Well, I think it is. It's very much based on that. And I suppose maybe that connects to your current inclination towards understanding rather than just almost manualized therapy. I know not all therapy is manualized, but very often CBT is quite manualized, by which I mean you're following a manual, you're following a bit of a program, rather than just understanding what's happening.
Yeah, I think professionally, I find the talking bit of talking therapies, I find quite often they're a bit like a magic trick, in that they'll kind of make sense, but they won't change the feeling, or they won't change the the fact that someone is really anxious and struggling to go outside. I think where real change happens when we work with people's motivations, what they're interested in, what they're, you know, what is going to get them out of bed in the morning. And we look at behavior and actually, what are you doing? I think.
So because this is a really important point about therapies, and it might be interesting to people. So what you're saying is that things like CBT or DBT, behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapies.
DBT.
Dialectical behavioral therapy.
Cool.
There you go. Knowledge. They magic tricks in the sense that they will convince the person in the moment that something's changed, but underneath hasn't necessarily.
Well, I should say it might be that I'm just not very good at them. This is just my personal experience as a therapist and as someone who's had it. I find, for example, I can talk to someone about, for example, let's say they've got social anxiety and they feel like everyone's looking at them. And I can kind of talk them through and help them see that, yes, logically that is a belief that doesn't make sense and that they've got no evidence for. But it doesn't stop them feeling like that's the case. There's that disconnect between thoughts and feelings. I find what's more powerful is saying, okay, you're really nervous about going outside. What, you know, is there, how far could you currently get outside before it felt too much? Or what situation would be too much and what would just be okay that you'd be able to manage? And actually gradually getting someone more comfortable in those situations that are still uncomfortable, but they're not going to cause them to be really, really stressed. It's that kind of baby steps. It's the actually doing it. You know, when I'm, you know, if I'm struggling with stress or mood, I find it's far more helpful for me to go out and to be in nature, to go for a run. I think physical exercise is one of the most effective ways to manage stress, anxiety, low mood. And I think it's those kind of, it's the doing that makes stuff happen, I think. Mm. Now, that's not to say CBT doesn't work for a lot of people. For a lot of people, CBT is great. And like I say, this might be that I'm just not particularly good at it. And it's why I don't tend to do much of it. I tend to do much more, more acceptance and commitment therapy, which is much more kind of behavioral based. And why I do a lot of kind of assessment, trying to understand how someone thinks.
It's interesting because you do an assessment, you're assessing not even a scientific way, but it's a kind of analytical way. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I have this sort of similar conversation with my wife and Tess's mum, who's a training in psychotherapy. And she has a similar critique of the kind of cognitive behavioral therapies, but from a psychotherapeutic angle of, let's explore the experiences and underlying feelings and embedded trauma, etc.
Yeah,
which is not a different approach to, well, it is a different approach to yours, but it shares with it an interest in the under in what lies beneath.
Shout out to your mum.
And you know your mum's right. The biggest, I'm pretty confident the research still stands, even though I've not read it in a while. But across psychological therapies, the biggest predictor of good outcomes is the therapeutic relationship.
Yeah.
It's the being with someone who's listening and interested and wants to understand. And lots of psychological therapies, I think, are the same kinds of things dressed up in different language.
Yeah, you and Sally need to talk, because that's what she says too.
But what I think is really important is having that person who's genuinely interested, genuinely wants to help you, genuinely wants to understand. And I think the power of someone just listening and having that curious, non-judgmental mindset of wanting to try and help, I think that by itself can go a long way.
Yeah, and when we do it right, we can do that in medicine, but we're just not given the time or the continuity of care
budget.
I'm going to growl now. It really won't come out well, so I'm not going to. But yes, I mean, it's incredibly frustrating because you're right, that is something that we can do alongside all of the medical stuff that's actually really helpful. And I think a good GP that's a lot of the skill. That's a lot of the magic of a good GP. Thinking of some of the people I've seen, it is listening and actually feeling like the other person is actually there as a person rather than just as a vessel for whatever manual or whatever diagnosis or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, whatever scan they're going to kind of lay upon you, that you're actually in the room as a patient or client, whatever you want to call it. I have my feelings about those words. Mm-hmm. But feeling like there's another person in the room, not just an agent of the state or an agent of the whatever psychological method you're using. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I even remember during my training the point where I felt like I knew the theory well enough to put that down a little bit and to just be me.
Yeah.
And that was a big moment in my training that I
it's a really good
really point. Progressed and felt more confident in what I was doing and was doing better at what I was doing.
Yeah. And it is, you can't just do it from the off. You have got to work out how to do the job, and then that's true actually. And then
getting into the swing of things.
Yeah, and then when you can start to bring your own stuff in. So yes, that's very true actually, and it is hard when you get started. Shall we do our final question?
Yeah.
I was reading in the Guardian.
We haven't even done the fourth one.
Oh gosh!
We were going to do the fourth one, and then I asked a question, and then we basically just answered.
Onwards! It's just I was reading in the Guardian this week that a good podcast should be an hour and 15 tops, and I'm exactly. We're hitting the hour mark. Never mind. The Guardian.
We can
ignore the Guardian.
One person's opinion. No.
Well, it was partly based on the fact that. They don't want a podcast to last more than one or two commutes. And I'm like, well, yeah, because in Guardian world, every commute is within London. So therefore.
Okay, fourth question.
Right, go on.
Looking back, is there anything you wish had been different?
I think more teachers. I think education can make such a difference, and I think there were a lot of teachers who, looking back, were really trying to help but didn't have the time, didn't have the understanding, didn't have the resources. And actually a huge amount of my waking hours were spent in school, and I think more teachers, so the teachers themselves have more time to spend, like we were saying, in the room to really try and understand someone, to take the time to know their students, to take the time to do, you know, bits of professional development actually in their working hours rather than having to cram it in after school in their evenings or in their weekends. I think teachers are miracle workers. I think they can do amazing things. And we need more of them, and we need to treat them a lot better.
It's one of the reasons I wanted to stay on at my current school is because the teachers already know me well and they already understand my neurodiversity.
You've got some really supportive
and I
people
don't
there.
Want to start over after that
because no,
it took so long. Maybe it's because I didn't have my diagnosis yet, but I think partially to, because obviously ADHD isn't just like, it's not the same in everybody. No. So it's just been really good to have that understanding in them.
And I was interested in what you say, Josh, because a lot of people have said, I wish the teachers had more understanding. I wish the teachers had different attitudes. But actually what you say is probably more helpful, because it's not that the teachers don't want to have the understanding. It's not that teachers are prejudiced necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just that there isn't the time and the headspace to properly understand their pupils. So actually more teachers is actually the answer.
I mean, then again, there are some teachers who are just bad.
Okay, yes.
I mean, I'm sure you have pediatricians and psychologists who fall into that category too.
More good teachers.
Sorry, say that again?
I say I'm sure that you have pediatricians and psychologists who fall into that category too.
Oh,
yeah.
God,
yeah. More. Let's just say more good teachers.
Yes.
Yes, I know. Yes, it's true. Don't get me started on some of the pediatricians.
What are you going to say? Some of the teachers. I was like, oh.
No, there's something going on.
I don't know about.
Really, seriously, don't get me started because I could get in trouble. Anyway, shall we? Well, that's the fourth question done. See, that I completely forgot about. Yeah, there you go. Hopes for the future, and then we can talk about your book.
That's my question to
ask. Okay, you take your ask the question.
What's
wrong with me
Excuse
today?
Excuse you. Hey, no, I'm trying to talk now.
I really should have taken my meds.
So, what are your hopes for the future?
I mean, firstly, to get over this cough.
Yeah, to not be coughing anymore. That's okay.
I'm hoping you can edit out half of these coughs and sniffles.
Yeah, people will be saying, what cough? Because Max will have edited these coughs so expertly.
You have like a millisecond of a cough.
I'll leave the last one in, because otherwise people really won't know what you're talking about.
I think we're in a really exciting time where we're getting neurodiversity is coming more to the fore. What I'm hoping to get to is a point where, I don't think we should be getting away, doing away with diagnoses, but where actually we're putting understanding a child's differences first, where we've kind of had that uncoupling between atypical and pathological, and where actually we're thinking about, a huge number of children going through education, a huge number of adults in employment are going to have some neurodevelopmental differences. So rather than let's focus on assessing all of these kids, let's focus on just generally, let's understand people who have different profiles of strengths and weaknesses and who think in different ways and have just supports generally built in for that. I think there's much more scope to build a neurodiverse, a supportive neurodiverse society that works for everyone. Now, I take your point from earlier that, it's you can't have a classroom for all the ADHD kids, and you can't have a classroom for the ASD kids. That in society, that's probably not going to be feasible. But I think having people generally more aware of what it's like to have ADHD and what kind of things can be helpful. Because actually a lot of strategies that are helpful for people with intellectual disability, for autism, for ADHD, for dyspraxia, anything. Not all of them are going to be helpful for everyone, but they're usually not going to do harm if you apply them with a bit of common sense and ask the person.
Mm.
And if they're helpful, then let's use them.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I think that 100% makes sense. I think we really need to better how we are educated on university, because there's no point in school, in the education system, where they sit us down and they go, this is what neurodiversity is.
Yeah.
The only things we know from our experiences and from what we consume in the media, which is where so many of these stereotypes come from, because we're never taught what they're actually like.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because they're important aspects of school life, particularly school life as opposed to other parts of life. And yet there isn't teaching on them. That doesn't make sense in a way.
No, there should be a PSHE lesson for that.
Yeah, there should.
There really should, because people need to understand. Understanding is the first step towards helping.
Is there PSHE on diversity more generally, on racial and sexual and gender diversity?
Yeah, there's not enough, but there is some.
Well, there's
some.
Never enough.
There's never enough.
But I suppose what you could do, just thinking about how you make a change in that way, you could lobby the PSA. You could lobby for the diversity curriculum of PSHE.
PSHE should be...
to include neurodiversity.
I think PSHE should be a more common subject. It should be at least once a week, because there's so much we need to learn. Much we need to learn, and we're just not learning it. We had one lesson... maybybe this is because of lockdown as well, but we had one lesson on diversity, like sexuality, and they were like, this is what gay means. Okay. Because we had a substitute for PSHE. She had no clue what she was doing. She was reading off of a piece of paper. That's not going to teach us anything.
International listeners, personal, social.
Oh, it's just life skills, basically.
Yeah, life skills education.
And I think
it's embarrassing because I've actually worked with that. a lot. Never mind.
Some of the, like, and she was just completely ignoring the fact that everyone was just going on their Chromebooks and not paying any attention to what she was saying.
It's not a subject which is respected within the teaching profession, I think.
No, not at all. And it should be. It's very, very important. Sorry, I've gone on a bit of a ramble there.
Tess is chair of the PSHE Association and a specialist PSHE teacher. We can look back on this conversation.
We will. I'm taking sociology for A-level as well. So
I think that's what you should do, Tess.
I want to.
I think this almost falls under... there's so many things I want to kind of come back to, because I think you're so right, Tess, and that I think PSHE should be about equipping people for life. And I think understanding your own neurodiversity, let alone academic, all the breadth of it, but actually taking some time to help kids to look at all the different aspects of, for example, attention, language, managing emotions. What are you good at? What do you find tricky? What are the kind of strategies you can use? I think that in a very practical and personal way could be hugely helpful. I think teaching people about mental health and about ways to recognize when that's starting to slip, what you can do just generally to help you look after yourself. I think self-care gets a really bad name. I think people roll their eyes when they talk about self-care, but actually it's so important. And when you let, I've experienced when I've let it slip, things go south very quickly. And I think equipping kids with these skills and these tools and this understanding at school, I think we would take a big bite out of the massive demand on mental health services, because we've got in there early, because we're talking about prevention and giving people these tools and normalizing before things get tricky.
Yeah,
and I think that applies as much to neurodiversity in terms of just understanding yourself and understanding what strategies work for you as it does to mental health.
I think that's absolutely right. Go on.
Also, I think if we teach students about like race and sexuality and neurodiversity, then they're not going to grow up and show... Well, they're less likely to grow up and show hatred towards these groups.
Well, it's worth a try.
Which is just going to... Yeah. And if it's going to help these people in the future. And I think people just... It's people... I don't know. I think... Yeah, like I was saying, I think we should take it more seriously because it can be really, really helpful for individuals and for how people treat those individuals.
Mm. Just speaking of helpful and educational, Josh, Josh, I've read your book and it's not out yet, but I was very lucky to get a proof copy. And I think it's not a math. It's not okay. It's a deliberately awkward segue, but in a sense, the way I felt your book was at a family level to do some of that education and to do some of that conveying an understanding of difference. A lot of the things you've been talking about, an understanding of difference and what are your, I suppose, so the book's called Developing Differently and it's out in June with published by Jessica Kingsley Press, I think.
Yes.
I did pay attention. why did you write the book and what are your hopes for it? That may be the same question.
Yeah. So I think there are lots of great resources out there for parents of very kind of articulate autistic people. What in my experience I found there's less of is stuff for parents of particularly young children with things like global developmental delay and intellectual disability, or kids who are diagnosed quite young as being autistic and a very limited language.
Mm.
And I think for those parents, start really early on in their journey of parenting this neurodiverse child, or this neurodivergent child rather, particularly a child who has, all children have lots of additional needs because they're children, but with a lot more needs, often due to language. I felt there wasn't really much out there for them. And it's something that in my clinical practice, I felt I was giving a lot of the same advice over and over.
Yeah.
And I thought that there must be a simpler way. And equally, one thing that I think isn't really talked about is, we were talking about self-care earlier, but parent self-care. And there are some parents I meet who love their child dearly and go above and beyond for their child. And often this child is really struggling and has really high support needs because, for example, things maybe aren't going well at school, or maybe we're still struggling to understand how we need to get this environment right for that child. And it's really tough for the parent. And actually, often my work is partly with a child and trying to understand that child, but also trying to help the parent look after themselves so that they can then meet this child's needs, who are a bit different to what they might have expected. So they have to think a bit harder. They have to work a bit harder. So that's why I kind of wrote it. I'm hoping it's something that for parents of children who are quite young, who are quite early on in that journey of trying to understand, quite early on in the journey of that child developing, and something they can hopefully come back to and kind of get things, just get the basics in place early on, and again, to try and prevent difficulties and try and understand that child a little bit better.
And I think it achieves achieves those aims. It's a fabulous book. And one of the things I think I put in the quote I gave you was, I wish I'd written it myself. it's not jealousy exactly, but I was like, oh yeah, it's not completely the book I've been stewing in my brain for the last 10 years, but yes, it's very close, and I'm never going to write that book. So this is a fantastic, for exactly that group, a fantastic guide to understanding and just making everything. It's so practical as well, and it's written with such empathy. For the children and also for the parents. But I mean, that must come from your own experience as well as everything else. Do you see what I mean?
I think certainly from my professional experience, from both, you know, the kids I meet, a lot of the kids I work with do have an intellectual disability. But I can still, whether it's just because of me, whether it's my autism, but I can still kind of relate to them, like the sensory bit, like someone who, I remember at school running my fingers along like the chain link fence and feeling the sensation of that as I walked and the rhythm of that, and hearing about a child who's doing the same, but with a fence. And I can kind of understand why, and I can understand why change can be so challenging, and why people changing their minds can be so challenging, or not doing things, or you interpreting things a different way, why that can be so challenging. So I know I won't do it fully for everyone, but I try as much as I can to get inside the head of the children that I'm working with, and I hope that translates to the book.
Wonderful. I think, well, we've breached the Guardian guidance of an hour and 15 minutes.
Oh, no!
A number of people in Shoreditch will have switched off by now.
No, not Shoreditch.
We've lost Shoreditch, but hopefully we've gained Moldova.
Yeah! That's what really matters.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the important people. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or plug or... sort of what's happening at the moment?
I don't think so. That said, if you ever fancy writing a book on assessment of neurodevelopmental differences, paediatrician, psychologist, ADHD, autism, I think could be a great combination.
All right, let's write that book.
Yeah.
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll be the one.
I got a 9 in my language, I think I'm set. Honestly.
Oh yeah, you can write the book as well. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I'll be the one having all of the stupid ideas, and you'll be the one telling me what to do, telling me how to go about it.
Just trying to bring you back to what's actually on paper.
Yeah, so you can make me more rigid. That would be good. Right. I was going to say my wife would like me to be more rigid, but that's a little rude. Tess has just given me the most horrendous look. Just
awkward silence.
Right, anyway, I'm going to stop it there because I've appalled my daughter and probably everyone else.
Yay! If you're in Moldova, please send us an Instagram message.
Thank you very much. Josh, I don't know that you're on social media or have any interest in being so. If people do, I mean, if people want to look out for the book, where will it come out? And what's the situation there?
Jessica Kingsley have all their social media, so it'll be out on that. I imagine, I hope. Jessica Kingsley website, you can buy it from that, or I've seen it listed at Amazon and Waterstones and other reputable bookstores. So I'm sure they'll be able to to find it. I think I am on Twitter. I don't tend to use it much because a bit like you, I'm not sure how I feel about it. They'll certainly, if they search for Developing Differently and Joshua Muggleton, they'll certainly find it.
I will do that, and I will put a reputable bookshop link in the show notes, not Amazon. And then we will hopefully boost your sales so that you come back, you know, from a Bahaman penthouse next time we talk.
You do not make money from writing books.
No, you do not.
I promise you that.
Absolutely right. Okay, thank you very much, Josh Muggleton. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye.
All right, so we're back, and Josh, what's up? That's probably the last episode we're going to do until probably the autumn, because we are very busy.
Yeah, we are.
You're very busy. You're away a lot over the summer, and I need to recharge a little bit, I think. Got some ideas for what we're going to do in autumn, but we will kind of let people know. If you do want to speak to us in a future series or season of the podcast, if you have an idea for a theme that we can have a few guests on the same theme, that's really fun, I think, having a theme. If you're somebody that just wants to have your story heard, we're definitely still listening out for those, particularly if your story is just a bit different, something unusual we might not have heard before.
Basically, if you have anything that you want to say, don't hesitate to just say it.
Yeah, so we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter and Facebook at Extra Brains Pod. Mm-hmm. And the website is extraordinarybrainspodcast.com.
True.
So, hope you can see us all there, and have a great summer. Tess is going camping again and all sorts of things.
I've got prom in a couple of days.
You've got prom in a couple of days. It's all very exciting, and you're going to become 16 quite soon.
I am.
All right. That is how we communicate now in this house. Bye.
I'm moving out.
Bye. See you.